Please be seated.
Okay, I've got some questions, and at least initially, these questions are directed at the controlled activity rule or the controlled activity pathway. And I understand your counsel, Mr. Page, to say that ORIG is accepting that there might be a controlled activity pathway. And I think the thrust of your evidence is that there should also be a controlled activity pathway. And you're nodding, so nodding yes. Means yes. Okay, very good for the record.
Sorry.
All right. And I know that in your evidence you've also proposed a discretionary pathway and there's also a non-complying pathway. Mm-hmm. And are you continuing to pursue the discretionary pathway? I just want to check that off.
Yes, although as I stated in my supplementary evidence in the Section 32 evaluation in Appendix C, I do acknowledge that could equally be framed as a non-complying activity. So,
your discretionary pathway could be non-complying.
That's right. So I stated there, and I think in the body of my evidence talked about. Whether there was value having something like my discretionary activity rule as I've proposed it as a non-complying activity. And then I guess why I went back to discretionary, I didn't actually know when I started drafting it whether I was drafting a discretionary or a non-complying activity rule. And I landed on the discretionary activity and my evidence because of the utility, whether there's that much utility, I guess I was questioning whether there's that much utility in terms of the gateway test, because the no more than minor is unlikely to be available, except for a very limited number of takes, which, you know, maybe a very small take out of a lake. With that Ngāti Rangi test in the mix and cumulative effects in the mix. So that gateway is shut pretty much for most applications. And then it's the policy gateway, and if we're writing a policy specifically, then actually maybe it's, you know, what is the actual merits of having that as a gateway, because here is the one policy that's providing that pathway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to ask you to put all of that to one side, and let's just focus on the controlled activity pathway.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have Mr. De Placemaker in his 14th of March document making suggested revisions to that pathway, and I think that those revisions are picked up in the joint witness statement filed by planners on Friday. Mm-hmm. And there may or may not have been, because I haven't done the comparison, some additional changes to that pathway, correct?
Yes, I think that most of our changes from in the joint witness statement were actually to the restricted discretionary rule.
Yeah. Okay. So I am interested in what are the gaps for the, if any, there may not be any, for the controlled activity pathway. Should applicants elect to go down a pathway where they are guaranteed to get a water permit? And Mr. De Placemaker has noted various conditions being rolled over. What is he missing? And this has, I suspect, everything or something at least to do with priorities and watershed agreements. And you can't ignore it.
No.
If there's something missing there, you can't, because you are favouring a full discretionary pathway and you know that's where your clients wish to go, you can't ignore the controlled activity, not if you're an expert planner giving independent evidence. So I need to close out the controlled activity rule.
Yeah. And I actually think that a lot of people might pivot, potentially, depending on the outcome of PC7, we might see a lot of applications actually pivot towards the controlled activity pathway, depending on how it lands. If it lands as a controlled activity pathway, if it's a process orientated and simple mm-hmm. one. So I do think it's critical. I think
so. Process orientated and simple. You said take out the environmental drivers or imperatives and take out efficiency. So that's what we started this morning. Okay, yeah. So I've taken them out. They're yeah. not there. So, what now is missing in that pathway?
So, yes, I agree. The kind of glaring one is the priorities and how we deal with the priorities.
I don't know that it's glaring. Why do you say that?
Oh, that's the first one that springs to mind with me. I can't actually think of... If we're trying to make a simple process orientated, then I can't think that there are other gaps. My concern with the priorities... I think that the lawmakers did anticipate that when priorities expired, there would be a full... don't know if they thought that far ahead in terms of 30 years, but we've certainly anticipated that there would be a full assessment of the activity that allowed for an understanding, as I described this morning, of how in any given set of circumstances those priorities have or haven't been exercised, and how the exercise of that both affects other water users and their access, but also the water body and the values in the water body, because as we've stepped through applications over the last few years, it has become clear that in some cases it can have an impact on the in-stream values as well. And so, to do that it's a comprehensive assessment of all the factors, and they're so interlinking in terms of the behaviours and the interactions and the placement and the catchment and to what degree they've been used. And then if you're going to replace them with something, what do you replace them with? What's the limit going to be? What infrastructure changes that? So there's a whole lot of interconnected complex factors. And so that's what we've been working with and working towards to date. And if we simply... if we simply roll over without that opportunity to undertake that full assessment, then to simply just stop priorities overnight, there is a risk, I think. I think it's a very real risk. It's both a risk to...
I don't know how you come to that statement, because that there is a risk and a real risk. And... we're in the business of looking at risks.
Sure.
So you now need to help me understand either catchment by catchment, based on your own experience, whether those priorities are being exercised, if they are, by whom and in what circumstance, or is it the case that the exercise is ad hoc, and therefore can't be, communicated in a series of principles.
So yes, I was going to say a risk is, it's twofold. It's in terms of, so I'll come back to how I, say that there's a risk. Twofold, it's a risk of... chaos is a bit of a strong word.
Yes, but it has been used and it was unhelpful. So how do we get to chaos, whatever that means? Firstly, define what chaos is.
So
if that is not your term, you should just disabuse the term and move on to something which is more helpful.
I'll try to think of an alternative term while I'm talking about it. But if you have... so this is between water users initially I'm talking now, and then there's the environmental stuff as well. So between water users, if you have priority one who has actively used his or her priority, and over a lower order priority, and they've actively used it, they bought the property on the basis, or developed their property on the basis of that access to water, and those priorities just disappear overnight. Will someone with a lower priority than them, situated higher upstream just suddenly start taking more water because the priority no longer exists.
Okay, so that's the first proposition. So yeah. An upstream lower order priority user takes more water than what they have done historically.
Yeah, and so when flows are dropping...
How could an upstream lower order user take more water than what they've done historically under the method which is proposed in this plan for regulating on the basis of historical use of water?
So it's the timing.
Right,
go on. I guess it's the timing of the abstraction. So they've got that history of use cap, yes, but the critical factor in terms of the first priority holder is about being able to tell the lower order priority holder to turn off or to reduce their take as flows start to drop. So number one says, hey, you know, you've got to turn down because I'm exercising my priority at the time, you know, the hottest, driest month. Say it's a hot, dry January. So it's about the timing of that access. So in the past, the higher order, the lower priority holder upstream might have taken significant amounts in spring and flood irrigated, and there was plenty of water. So they might still have a history of use to justify that taking, but now they switch if the priorities disappear overnight. They could still be within their history of use, but they're accessing water and they're not turning off for the person further downstream when flows are critical. They let go of some of their water in the spring.
Yeah. And is this where you've gotten to, or where the technical experts have gotten to in their joint witness statement? But now history of use is one thing, but the use now becomes quite... The use in different months is no longer reflected in terms of what the pattern of usage might have been.
I don't know if we got to this, but we certainly didn't get into the specifics of that.
You see, I need to flag it because I need to close out the controlled activity rule because it seems most people are wanting to go in that in that place, unless, of course, we reject the whole thing. So what are you recommending be done next by the technical people? Firstly, how do we know? And you've got, when you have that recommendation, you've also got to keep in mind, do we know anything about who is actually exercising priorities? And I've got to move away from the anecdotal and generalisation, otherwise,
So I guess the problem with priorities and why they're so vexing is because we don't know until we start working in a comprehensive fashion with a particular set of applicants how they've been using them. So the face value of the permit only tells you about the entitlement, not how they've been used and to what degree they've been used. In terms of the technical experts, sorry to put a question back to you, but are you meaning in terms of some kind of methodology which looks at history of use across months so that you can't shift your...
I don't know. You're the planner and you're not opposing, in principle, a controlled activity pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking you, are there gaps? And you're saying potentially. And now I would need to know how to bridge those gaps. Because otherwise you've supported a controlled activity rule which you've loosely said, oh, that could be chaotic. Is the court likely to go there?
And my proposal had been that priority simply got carried over, and I understand that you've got concerns with that from a legal
twofold
position.
If you can carry them over, how do we carry them over? Just so assuming you can carry them over, what does that look like in this plan? And I suspect it doesn't look like just saying the word priority and everything follows. I think much more is required. But, you know, that's drafting. That can be done. if you can't carry them over, and so there's a policy gap now, then what do you fill the gap with?
So for the first part of that, in terms of if they can be carried over, I had anticipated that it would simply be a mirror of what was in the existing permits, bringing notes up into the conditions if they exist in notes, and then they are something that simply sits there and are available to be utilised between the consent holders and, you know, with the regional council as the backstop to that.
So this is, okay, so what I imagined, if they can be carried over, is that you would need to have a definition of deemed permits so that we would know what was being caught, which is deemed permits which continue to exist, I guess, 31 August.
Yeah.
So it's not deemed permits or deemed permits, you know, because some of those have been replaced already. So it's just that bunch which are currently in effect now. And you may or may not also require a schedule of those deemed permits, and we may or may not also require for this plan change notation for that schedule as to what were the orders of priorities. I would hope that's not too difficult, because regions should have that information to hand, but it's not just a case of saying the magic word priorities and it all happening. I wouldn't have thought in terms of plan drafting. Do you want to comment on that?
So I'm trying to think through the, you know, the that transition and scheduling that. And I'm trying to recall off the top of my head whether there is a definition in the Act around priorities. So beyond the wording within the sections, I don't think there is. So I think that would be, workable with some kind of, and I don't know if you would actually need to even define or link it specifically to deemed permits, because many of them, you know, they not necessarily have a deemed permit title at the top of them now, as you say. Some of them have been replaced with priorities. So whether it's actually just a schedule of specific consents with priorities, whether as part of the controlled activity rule, part of that process is to look at sets of priorities and specifically require the applicants to identify whether they utilise their priorities within that subset, and whether they want them to carry over as part of the application process. And so that would allow some kind of reconciliation and sifting out of areas where they're not being used. So only those where they're being used and the applicants want them to carry over, and that, then that they would be carried over. Does that make sense? And so that's almost part of that controlled activity process, is, you know, the onus is on the applicant then to identify the use of the priority and whether they want them to carry on going forward. And it may be that we need to have, you know, groupings of those controlled activity applications by those priority subsets.
I understand, and I set this out in the minute, and I'm assuming that you have seen the minute dated the 7th of April, dealing with priorities? Oh, deemed permits, okay. And I say at paragraph 8 that the exercise of priority to water is limited to cases where water is flowing in a watercourse, you know, water body, is insufficient to supply fully to races that are connected to the same. So that's coming straight out of the legislation in terms of drawing in definitions, I think, from the Water and Soil Conservation Act. Is that, and then a race is defined also under the same act as meaning any artificial channel or ditch for the conveyance of water, or into or in which water may be diverted, conveyed, or for any authorised purpose. So that's what it's about. It's about supplying water to races. Mm. Is it your understanding that, or your experience for those persons exercising priorities, that they are indeed exercising priorities to ensure that water is available to the higher priority user to put into a water race and not for any other circumstance?
I did read that and think, oh, I wonder about pipes. Are pipes covered in that?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think of specific examples where it's being pumped or piped instead of into a race.
And by pipe, do you mean a gallery?
Sometimes there's a pipe sitting in a submerged pipe is actually the intake in a waterway, and then it might stay in a pipe, or it might the pipe might feed into an open race. Galleries, submerged shallow bore, and some system of piping, involved with that.
So, that's interesting, which is why I reflected this back. This is a definition coming out of the Act. So RMA referencing now into the Water and Soil Conservation Act, very specific definition about priorities and what they mean in terms of ensuring access to water to supply a race. And is it your evidence that you don't know that priorities are being exercised for the purpose of supplying a water race?
I don't know if they're only being exercised
question. You don't know?
No, I can't tell you that categorically. And in dealing with priorities, had not something we just worked with day to day, hadn't actually seen that definition before your minute.
Well, you can check it out. I mean, it's a matter for the lawyers as well, but you can check it out. I just grabbed that out of the RMA. Okay.
And it does reflect what Otago would have looked like at the time the RMA came into being. Yeah.
So you don't know whether or not priorities are only being exercised for the purpose of supplying, a superior water supply race.
No.
Race, yeah. Is it your experience that it has gone beyond that? Or other circumstances have been applied?
I actually just don't know. The ones that I can think of off the top of my head are water races, but I can't assure you that they're only water races.
Okay. All right. So you don't know that, and you don't know in relation to their rights of priority, which are there, how many of those rights are currently being exercised or in what circumstances?
I'm sorry, but I can't give you a specific number.
But all you know is that some of your clients have.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
And I've described this as being a non-regulatory sort of method, because it's not really a method that involves the Regional Council, and it's not a method reflected in resource consent terms or permit terms. Would that be correct, other than reflecting the fact that there's a right of priority?
Yes.
So it's non-regulatory, it's as between permit holders. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I also said that that's what a watershare agreement was as well. Well, at least I put it out there, because actually I don't know. Watershare agreement's a non-regulatory method. It's an agreement entered into by two or more permit holders on the same water body. And it sounded like, in response to Commissioner Edmonds' questions, whilst you'll tell the Regional Council about that in an application for resource consent, you don't invite the Regional Council to impose conditions that mirror or reflect that water share agreement. Is that correct?
That's correct today. I would note that the Lindis, there was a specific condition which referenced that a water sharing agreement was required, but it did not go into the detail of what that should look like.
Was that an initiative of the court or of Lindis as an applicant?
It was the applicant, and that evolved out of negotiations right before going to court, and then it got refined through the process as to what the wording was.
So why is that not reflected, the existence of a water share agreement, why is that not reflected in consent conditions?
The specifics of it?
Yes.
Because it can... with the example of the Lindis, it was because it hadn't been trialled yet, so... The abstractors wanted to retain some flexibility about how they might carry out that flow sharing. So whether it would be, what exactly would be the trigger flow, the amount that they might drop down on, the percentage that they might drop down on. So just to allow for some flexibility and some adaptiveness and learning along the way, and also that every season's slightly different. So that was the basis for that.
So aside from the example of Lindis, has any other resource consent decision that you are aware of reflected in the conditions of consent the existence of a flow sharing agreement and the terms of that agreement?
Not the terms of the agreement, no, not that I'm aware of. I know that there's a water allocation committee in the Kakanui, but I'm not at all familiar with that, so I can't speak to that. Ms McKeague or Mr Higgy would be able to speak to that. So consents... and we propose a condition of consent with application which refer to the applicant agrees to be party or a member of a water management group for this catchment. And that is about as much as usually gets in the consent.
So why is that?
Again, for the reason of allowing... the rationale has been for allowing... the abstractors to come up with an adaptive approach that they can kind of work through and adjust if necessary. It's kind of a learn-as-you-go process, I guess.
Okay, so your evidence is that of those water share agreements, the fact of their existence may be noted in the consent conditions, either as a fact they exist or be... a requirement to be a part of a water sharing group, but that the terms of those water sharing agreements are not recorded in consent conditions, and the reason for that is that that is a method, again a non-regulatory method, as between abstractors, where the controlling matter is to enable abstractors to retain flexibility over water use.
To retain flexibility about how they reduce their takes, yeah, as it approaches a flow limit, yeah. Yes.
Water sharing agreements, are they contingent on a minimum flow, however that is calculated?
So not just a minimum flow, sometimes they can be on a residual flow. Mm. So in the residual flow, maybe the trigger residual flow may be at the bottom of a catchment. And so that's what we've proposed for the Manahirakea, that there are, within those applications, that there are trigger residual flows. But because those are just proposed, they are not an actual flow limit at the moment, and we don't know if that's what would actually eventuate out the other side of a process.
All right. Well, getting back into the controlled activity route, is there any utility recognising either priorities or recognising water share agreements? Start with priorities.
I think there's utility in recognising priorities and...
What is the utility?
The utility is twofold, both in terms of retaining existing access between water users, so managing effects between water users, and the second one being the potential retention of flows over a longer length of a waterway resulting from a higher priority being further downstream and exercising priority over a lower order priority, so they have to turn off. And so the potential for environmental benefits there.
So you haven't...
Oh, sorry, there was a second part to that question.
Yeah, no, water sharing agreements, we'll get to it. You haven't addressed, other than the naming of priorities, as a fact they're named in the plan somewhere, you haven't discussed, that I can recall, but then we've got about 10,000 pages worth of evidence, so you'll forgive me. You haven't discussed whether or not the policies in particular need to talk to the dual purposes of priorities, whether they're retained, because you can retain them after 1 October, or whether they're created, that's a new tool created to speak to that gap.
So the policies in PC7?
Yes. Should you have?
Yes, I should have.
Okay,
yes.
So what... I'm not asking you to draft on the hoof, but what should have been reflected in the policies of PC7 such that the priorities or a new tool reflecting, mimicking priorities were brought forward?
So, yes, because I think it was... We'd simply... I'd simply added the words...
Priority.
Yes,
If it helps, the court trying to problem solve in this space talks about possible way forwards from paragraph 24, and in particular paragraph 24A, allowing some recognition in this plan of allowing other permit holders to continue to take water. So there we were thinking that's either a new tool or it's the old tool priorities, either way. But that's the space that you're working in. But in saying that, something much more may be required. Mm. So I'm really wanting you to reflect on that and tell me what your thoughts are.
So that's right. I was just checking back on where it had been mentioned in the policies. And so it was very much just an add-on, extra comma. So potentially it's separating that out into a separate subparagraph of 10A.2.1. Because that's really the controlled activity policy, and having it as
I'll just go grab your own relief.
It's difficult to simply insert that, because that policy is a very focused in terms of where it's acceptable to just grant. Um, something along the lines of where a priority has been exercised either for the either to protect access to water or or may retain in-stream flows. But the difficulty with that is that then that requires an actual substantive assessment.
Oh, it requires evidence, yeah. Doesn't it? And if you think irrigation areas are difficult, frankly, I struggle with that. But anyway, if you think irrigation areas are difficult, how do you think they're going to come up with proof of that?
In terms of retaining in-stream flows?
Well, in terms evidence as to exercise.
And so again, it would have to form part of the application, and and in terms of evidence, if it was brought in, and it was a whole subset, and you did have, say, you know, number one saying I exercise my priority, and number two saying yes, this has been done. Again, you're relying, it's reliance really on the applicant's statement. And when we develop applications, that's exactly what we're doing, is we're talking to those consent holders.
What would the control look like if a new method or a new tool is required because, in fact, you just can't bring down priorities because they are a creature of statute and because they will cease on the 31st of August, so you need a new tool. So what does that tool look like?
So if we can't simply carry priorities over?
Yeah. Or if you have to recreate priorities in some way, because of, yeah.
At best, I think a take cessation condition again, or a take reduction and cessation, because it's not always simply about turning off, it's about turning down. Condition linked to other permits.
Okay.
And so, if priority one is above four other permits, so if you've got five priorities, priority one would have the take cessation and reduction condition that is linked to four others. Priority two would have one that's linked to three other permits, etc., until you get down to number four that's only linked to number five. That would be about the only other way I could see it. And again, that would require information from the applicants. I don't see, and this gets to the other part of your question that you posed earlier, with the flow sharing, I don't see...
No, I don't want to go there. Just park that up. I'll go there next.
Okay.
All right. I'm trying to problem solve.
Yeah.
On priorities.
Yeah.
Okay. And I suspect you need to problem solve on priorities, even if they survive after 1 October, or can survive after 1 October. I think it's quite probably the same issue will need to be addressed. Other than the recital of the word priorities, what does that actually mean?
Mm.
Yeah. So, again, you see that as a non-regulatory method, or do you see it as a method where region gets involved and starts to enforce the cessation or reduction on behalf of, you know, the superior permit holders?
I think that's the ultimate backstop when it's a condition of consent. As with a lot of conditions of consent, they're self-regulating. We expect them to be self-regulating. Mm. And that's what I think would have to happen in this case. And that's the history of deemed permit operation in Otago, that it has been a self-regulated with, going to an enforcement agency. Regional council as a very last backstop, and the regional council had given strong messaging throughout the years, is my understanding, that they weren't interested in getting involved between the parties, and I think that's consistent with the evidence of Mr. De Pelsmaker, that it hadn't been something that the regional council wanted to get involved in. But I think if they're brought in as modern conditions, then I think that would have to be part of it. I don't think it would be utilised very much because priority holders are very used to dealing with it between themselves.
So can you have policy support for a non-regulatory method in a plan, regional plan?
We currently do.
Mm-hmm.
We currently have policy support for water management groups, a shared approach to water management. So it would be around supporting the retention of historic systems of priorities. Maybe not the word priority, if that's, going to be moved on from. Although that word is very well understood amongst Otago water users.
And in your view, I mean, I know you talk about, that's your ultimate, not sure actually whether permit holders would think it was their ultimate goal to have the regional council enforcing priorities. Should it be something that is enforceable, or should it be something where there is policy support for the recognition of priorities, but priorities remain a non-regulatory method? The exercise of priorities remaining a non-regulatory method.
That's an interesting question, because I think potentially having a legal backstop over the years has given them weight.
Mm.
And so if you take that way away altogether, is there a risk of undermining them? But yes, I acknowledge they are essentially a non-regulatory matter between.
Mm.
So I think it would be useful to keep that regulatory backstop there if possible, just as there has existed in the past.
Mm-hmm. All right. The purpose of priorities are what? Going forward, if they are recognised going forward, is that ensuring that water remain available for permit holders with a superior priority, or is it environmental?
I think it's both. I think yes, definitely to the first one, because that's the clear and obvious in terms of the history of priorities and development on farms and the value of the water, the permit that they hold. But we do know that in cases, particularly in the tributaries, that they have resulted in water staying in stream.
But are they being exercised for that purpose?
No.
No. And so that's, again, what we're driving at.
Yeah.
You say this is process only. It's not process plus. It's not environmental and it's not efficiency. Okay, I've taken that on board. Why then are we defaulting to there's an environmental benefit that needs to be recognised in the priority? To me, that's a sidewind for what has only been a tool which is available to meet abstractive demands.
You're absolutely right. I think in the plan, it will have to be about retaining that access, because this isn't a full assessment under the controlled activity. It's not even a part assessment of the environmental factors. And if you only look at one aspect, then you know all those interconnected parts won't work or won't be properly assessed. So I think that's a potential benefit of recognising priorities with regard to abstractors access, may be that we retain the status quo, as much as it is a status quo, over those 6 years, and potentially reduce some environmental risk. But it can't be the purpose in the controlled activity pathway, because that suddenly brings in a whole lot of assessment that we just can't do through that pathway.
And does that reflect also that the exercise of priority may have had an incidental environmental benefit, but that those benefits might also themselves be an expression of wider things happening within the water body?
Yes, very much. Yeah.
Not solely attributable to the exercise of a priority.
The environmental benefits?
Yeah.
No.
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 Okay. All right, flow sharing agreements. Anyway, you've clarified something which is very helpful for me, is that while there are policy recognising flow sharing agreements, and I talk about that in a minute, this is a non-regulatory method.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't get picked up and expressed in conditions of consent.
Yes, that's correct.
I understand from evidence which is to come that those flow sharing agreements, where they've been entered into, replace, if you like, the exercise of priorities.
Yes, and sorry, I'd just say, again, I think the Kakanui might be an example of a flow sharing agreement, which is actually recorded on consents, but I'm not familiar.
Okay.
So, yeah. So the ones I'm familiar with, I haven't seen any flow sharing agreements specifically set out in consents. And sorry, what was the...
That the flow sharing agreement, the evidence to come is that flow farmer interest evidence is that on some occasions at least flow sharing agreements replace deem permits.
Yes.
Is that the case always, that flow sharing agreements replace deem permits?
No, it entirely depends on the situation. So if... in some cases, we have deem permits, which are a single permit on a tributary going into the Clutha. So there is essentially no one else to flow share with in terms of, you know, downstream users on the Clutha.
Mm.
It's, not linked in terms of those hydrological conditions experienced on that one trib.
There's a flow sharing agreement in that case?
No, there's not.
There's not, right.
Sorry. So we've got examples where there are no deem permits that are replaced without a flow sharing
without
agreement.
Without a flow sharing agreement, because there's no one there to...
That's right. And in other cases, so they can be replaced simply by a system of residual flows, and a flow sharing agreement hasn't been developed. And I can think of a group of applicants on the Poolburn main stem we actually, it wasn't seen to be necessary to have a flow sharing agreement. It was just a series of residuals, and that was actually seen as sufficient. A flow sharing agreement didn't add anything. So it's about the hydrological connections and conditions between those users. And again, the Pigburn, the bulk of the applicants have gone forward with just their residual flows, complete, you know, restructure of take infrastructure for three of them, and it's only between two of them that a flow sharing aside agreement would be developed, and that's just for the priorities between those two. So it can vary even within, you know, a sub-catchment level. And again, they're always predicated on that full assessment of, okay, what is the flow limit that we're sharing to? And at the tributary scale, where a lot of these priorities are, you know, kind of critical between each other, it's about developing that flow limit first to then get an understanding of how that affects people's access to the water.
So, again, we've heard lines of questions in cross-examination that there are flow-sharing agreements everywhere and that they always have an environmental benefit. I mean, that's really the driver for them. Do you want to comment on that? Every catchment we were led to believe would have a flow-sharing agreement, and that every flow-sharing agreement, the outcome principally is one that benefits the environment. That's what's driving it.
I think there are a lot that will have flow sharing agreements. I think particularly in the Manahiria Kea, there will be, for the main tributaries where there are permits being replaced, there will be internal kind of flow sharing, and there will be a broader flow sharing agreement across the catchment. There are pockets of either tributaries or areas on a main stem where, as I said, either residual flows or minimum flows mean that they'll just that they might not have a flow sharing agreement, or they might become party to one further down the track. So it will, anticipating, be a little bit iterative like that. More people might join, or other people outside of the tent may get a condition on their consent requiring them to be part of a catchment flow sharing agreement. In terms of there being environmental benefit, the key environmental benefit is first and foremost the setting of the flow limit and adherence to that, and then also the motivation of the abstractors not to reach that flow limit and be cut off altogether. And so again, it's about fairness and equity and between those abstractors as they move down towards that flow limit, and that creates in itself an environmental benefit because it keeps flows above whatever the flow limit is.
You mean the minimum flow?
Minimum flow or residual flow. And so it will reduce that kind of the flatlining effect by its very nature.
So question for you. So many, many catchments have them. Their principal purpose is to ensure equity and fairness as between abstractors, where the flows in the river are now moving towards a minimum flow, however that's been calculated. The minimum flow itself is the, and recession flows are there to benefit the in-stream environment. So with that in mind...
It's just one part of that question. It's not quite right. Many catchments have them. Quite a few catchments we're anticipating.
Yep.
And have a draft based on a draft proposed flow limit, say in the Manahiri Kea, but they don't actually exist yet. Some of those details haven't been fleshed out. They were anticipating potentially trialling them, refining them, So if we'd gone right through the consent process under the operative plan, yes, I think we would have ended up with a lot of flow sharing agreements, a lot of which the detail might have been developed alongside that application process once there was greater clarity around where the flow limit would actually land, because we've only just proposed, you know, we've proposed them, but whether or not that's what gets through is something else entirely. So there was a lot of water under the bridge still with a lot of those.
All right. So talking about the first case, many catchments will have them. Is it your evidence that for any catchment that does have a flow sharing agreement, that that agreement will reflect minimum flows, at least, which are consistent with policy? I think it's 6.4.2. of the operative plan, you know, the one of three ways of calculating a limit.
That's the allocation limit?
Yeah. No, that's the allocation limit, so that's not quite right. The minimum flows.
So Schedule 2A minimum flows?
Yeah, so outside Schedule 2A, what's the method in the plan, the operative plan, to calculate minimum flows?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and have a look.
Policy about that?
On minimum flows hidden somewhere. A default. Some useful matters that you might consider when setting a minimum flow. And maybe that doesn't only relate to Schedule 2A. That might relate to something you want to put forward in an application. I'm sorry, it's sort of coming back to me.
Yeah, I'd need to have a look at the plan.
I think it seemed an odd place to have it in the plan because it had a lot of quite useful things in it.
Yeah.
Probably can't find it in 5 minutes.
I will do that over lunch. We will direct you to have a look at it over lunch. And sure. I know we've gone beyond 45 minutes, but if we don't close this out, we are going to have a lot of problems with this plan change, should the plan change be confirmed. So, many catchments have them, and they're working towards a minimum flow. And the question for you, is that minimum flow set as between irrigators, or is that minimum flow something which comes out of a policy or a methodology in the water plan?
So where there is no 2A minimum flow...
Yeah, where there's no 2A, yep.
Then it is not, from memory, and I will check this, there's not actually a kind of a default minimum flow that applies. There is a default process for supplementary flow setting. It's more an indication in those policies that if one is set, then that will be inserted into 2A and applied by review. Other than that, if there is no 2A, so in all the TRIBs coming into the CLUTHA, which are dealt with as their own kind of primary allocation block, and are all fully allocated, pretty much, then it's about setting. We try and develop a residual flow as part of that application process.
Again, I need to bring you right back to your water share agreements, which is the only thing I'm interested in.
Yep.
Your water sharing agreements for the catchments that have them are going to be matters of fairness and equity between the abstractors will have come up with a minimum flow or alternatively perhaps a recession residual flow, depending on the water body that you're in, or both. But what? Whatever's in those agreements, if they're outside of Schedule 2A, then these are matters which the abstractors have come up with themselves, as opposed to any consent process or plan change process.
Yes, very much so. So until it's been through the whole consent process...
For Schedule 2A?
No, if it's a residual flow, then if it's been right through the consent process and, we're out the other side, we get agreement, decision, it's, we've proposed 100 litre a second residual flow and everybody agrees, then that's the flow limit, or 150 if that's what comes out the other side. And if you're not in a Schedule 2A minimum flow catchment, then it will again be something that we've proposed, and it has to work through the system to actually know if that's what ends up landing on the other side.
So those minimum, those flow sharing agreements outside of Schedule 2A, are there any flow sharing agreements which exist in any water body or in any catchment where the minimum flows or residual flows are not yet part of any condition of consent? In other words, farmers have got together and have said, look, to make this work, this is what we've got to do with minimum flows and residual flows. To make this work, i.e. to ensure that I have water I can continue to abstract, this is how we need to be managing ourselves.
So flow sharing without a limit? No.
No. So flow sharing agreements have only come into being where there is a general need, I guess, within a catchment or on a water body to go through a consenting process.
Yes.
Then there's a flow sharing agreement. Terms of the flow sharing agreement, the fact of their existence is noted in the consent conditions, if that is it. If there's a minimum flow or if there's a residual flow, that is tested, and to that extent only those two provisions come down onto a resource consent.
Yes.
Okay. So, okay.
So they're very much a child of the full consent process.
That's what we're getting at.
Yes.
So that's new and important. Flow sharing agreements are a child of a consenting process.
A full assessment.
A full assessment,
yes.
Yeah, because you're getting your minimum flows and
yep.
you're getting your... Yep. Okay, so that's not this.
No.
Okay, so is there any utility to
no.
be recognising flow share agreements?
No, not
no.
in the controlled activity
okay.
pathway.
All right, that's helpful. Because we've been talking about outside of Schedule 2A, inside of Schedule 2A is there outside of a full merits-based assessment of water permits, is there any utility in recognising flow sharing agreements?
No.
And is that simply because you're not going to have folk put up minimum flows or residual flows without that full
assessment? That's right.
Okay.
Also understanding the drop in reliability, what that means for on-farm changes, etc. There's the whole big complex.
Yeah. And so when the regional council says, look, if you've got a residual flow, a minimum flow, already as a condition of consent, if you bring that forward, that's actually all that really needs to be done. You don't need to be noting the existence or otherwise of a flow sharing agreement. From the regional council's perspective, you've got the two drivers of environmental outcomes.
Yes, that's right. Unless there are, the Kakanui, unless that does have it actually in the consents, unless that is an outlier. And again, I'm not familiar with that one. Yep.
Okay. Checking my other questions from some responses that you've given. Thank you. So it seems to me, from what you've said, particularly in answers to Commissioner Edmonds, what is critical under a controlled activity pathway is that you are not changing the reliability of supply,
mm-hmm.
and you're nodding.
Yes.
Is that correct? Because to change the reliability of supply such that it's less reliable, farmers will need to start to take measures to respond to that, including on-farm storage or change in irrigation
yes.
systems to become more efficient, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Or to offset that loss of reliability.
To offset the yep. loss of reliability.
Yep.
So, aside from recognition of priorities, either as they exist or some other new tool that does the job, what other tools are needed to ensure that there isn't a change in reliability under the controlled activity pathway?
So it's really what you don't do.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really that you don't introduce new flow limits. You don't reduce actual access to water. And again, I think where the schedule has now landed with maximums rather than the average of maximums addresses that. I think it's just really what you don't do.
Okay. So the gap, if you like, is the gap which we've been talking about in terms of priorities.
Yeah.
That needs further discussion and further thinking. Flow sharing agreements doesn't sound like it's going to result in any benefit here.
No.
Otherwise, where the regional council has come to, especially, I guess, through also expert conferencing, we're meeting your concerns about what it is that you don't do in terms
yes.
of impacting that reliability. Okay. I was interested, and I took the time to read over parts of the Lindis decision, both the plan change and also the resource consents, and quite lengthy decisions.
Yes.
But as I understand it, that there was a proposal there for the Lindis catchment to move away from races to a series of galleries and bores. Is
mm-hmm.
that?
That's right.
That's right.
Dispersed infrastructure.
Dispersed infrastructure.
Not entirely. Some races remained.
Oh, some races remained as well. Okay. But that for the first 5 years, in recognition that there was a change to infrastructure, am I right in thinking that the volumes or the rates of take or volume expressed on a deem permit remained for the first 5 years to ensure that the race systems which were being replaced could continue to take sufficient water and distribute it? Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, that's right. So the for the first 5 years, they could continue accessing what they'd historically accessed because they were still utilising
the races.
And then within that five-year period, they had basically 5 years to transition away from the use of the races, acknowledging that it's going from a company supply to dispersed private takes, and that they each needed to obtain to actually put in the infrastructure to deal with that.
From those applications that you've been involved mm-hmm. personally, how many of those applicants are seeking something similar in terms of the, at least for an initial period of years, where new infrastructure is being proposed, the higher rate of take or volume on a deemed permit continues until the infrastructure is in place?
I don't think any.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some applications, we may request, say, a 5 to 10 year period for new infrastructure to be put into place.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in all cases, it's not the full deem permit, definitely not in terms of volumes that is replaced. It is brought down to that history of use cap, or the lesser of the history of use or the Equilink reasonable use assessment. And that was really in the Lindis and recognition. And I would have to go back and check to whether we applied for the full. I think we still only applied for the, in the first 5 years, the history of use cap, and then potentially bringing that. I need to check the details. So it wouldn't have been the full deem permit extrapolated volume, which is, you know, just
huge.
That's yeah. Right. And it hadn't been accessed. So there's no point in replacing that. But, yeah, the focus in other applications is really about requesting some time to transition infrastructure.
Prohibited activity to continue using
the races.
Those three major races.
That's
a
right.
Sort of belt and braces is the only lever you could pull to make sure that somebody didn't apply to continue on using those.
That's right.
That's my memory of it.
Yes. Yep.
Alrighty. Well, those are my questions. And that's been really helpful for our thinking.
So I don't think looking at the business about the policy on minimum flows and debt, I don't think it's any help.
Anybody got any questions arising?
Here on it. I want to stay with the vexed topic of priorities, and I use that word carefully. When you're having your discussions with current permit holders and you're working through the process of preparing applications, and these, I have in mind these group applications, is it the understanding of the current permit holders that their priority will expire on 1 October 2021, or is the expectation that the priority will continue on reconsenting?
No, they're very much aware that they will expire, and that's part of the motivator to come together as a group and work through the process together as a group, I think.
So staying with the priorities now, and let's say they roll over for the next 6 years and that the plan change 7 can be crafted in a way to bring the existing priorities down. The fact of whether or not the priorities are actually implemented or not isn't particularly relevant. Do you accept that if they simply come down, it leaves the ability open for them to be exercised?
Yes.
And so an assessment wouldn't need to be made as to whether or not the priorities have been exercised, because permit holders are not required to exercise a priority, are they?
Yep, potentially that would be okay.
Now, there's been quite some discussion around irrigable areas, and we had some questions about that a couple of weeks ago. I just want to understand, in terms of the applications that you have been involved in with respect to the Manahera Care, have you specified, or do those applications specify the current irrigable area?
Yes, they do. And I have no issue with an irrigation area as such. My concern really rests on, you know, proof at a certain date, retrospectively, and what proof may or may not be accepted. So it was really around clarity around that.
So with respect to those applications, how have you specified the existing irrigable area?
As hectares, total hectares, and that's based on mapping.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right, thank you. Anybody else? Ms. Irving? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Dicey. It's a long time on the stand, I know, but it has been really helpful for us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I think we'll take the lunchtime adjournment and come back at quarter to two. Yep. Thank you.
Please all stand.